Chapter 88. The donkeys were all good, all handsome, all strong and in good condition, all fast and all willing to prove it. They were the best we had found anywhere, and the most rechurch. I do not know what rechurch is, but that is what these donkeys were, anyhow. Some were of a soft mouse color, and the others were white, black, and very dash colored. Some were close-shaven, all over, except that a tuft like a paintbrush was left on the end of the tail. Others were so shaven in fanciful landscape garden patterns, as to mark their bodies with curving lines, which were bounded on one side by hair, and on the other by the close plush left by the shears. They had all been newly barbered, and were exceedingly stylish. Several of the white ones were barred like zebras with rainbow stripes of blue and red and yellow paint. These were indescribably gorgeous. Dan and Jack selected from this lot, because they brought back Italian reminiscences of the LD Masters. The saddles were the high, stuffy, frog-shaped things we had known in Ephesus and Smyrna. The donkey boys were lively young Egyptian rascals who could follow a donkey, and keep him in a canter half a day without tiring. We had plenty of spectators when we mounted, for the hotel was full of English people bound overland to India and officers getting ready for the African campaign against the Abyssinian King Theodorus. We were not a very large party, but as we charged through the streets of the great metropolis, we made noise for 500, and displayed activity and created excitement in proportion. Nobody can steer a donkey, and some collided with camels, dervishes, effendis, asses, beggars and everything else that offered to the donkeys a reasonable chance for a collision. When we turned into the broad avenue that leads out of the city toward Old Cairo, there was plenty of room. The walls of stately date palms that fenced the gardens and beordered the way, threw their shadows down, and made the air cool and bracing. We rose to the spirit of the time, and the race became a wild rout, a stampede, a terrific panic. I wish to live to enjoy it again. Somewhere along this route we had a few startling exhibitions of Oriental simplicity. A girl apparently 13 years of age came along the great thoroughfare dressed like Eve before the fall. We would have called her 13 at home, but here girls who look 13 are often not more than 9, in reality. Occasionally we saw stark naked men of superb build, bathing, and making no attempt at concealment. However, an hour's acquaintance with this cheerful custom reconciled the pilgrims to it, and then it ceased to occasion remark. Thus easily do even the most startling novelties grow tame and spiritless to these sight-surfeited wanderers. Arrived at Old Cairo, the camp followers took up the donkeys, and tumbled them bodily aboard a small boat with a lateen sail, and we followed and got underway. The deck was closely packed with donkeys and men. The two sailors had to climb over and under and through the wedged mass to work the sails, and the steersman had to crowd 4 or 5 donkeys out of the way when he wished to swing his tiller and put his helm hard down. But what were their troubles to us? We had nothing to do, but enjoy the trip, nothing to do, but shove the donkeys off our corns and look at the charming scenery of the Nile. On the island at our right was the machine they call the Nilometer, a stone column whose business it is to mark the rise of the river and prophesy whether it will reach only 32 feet and produce a famine, or whether it will properly flood the land at 40 and produce plenty, or whether it will rise to 43 and bring death and destruction to flocks and crops. But how it does all this, they could not explain to us so that we could understand. On the same island, is still shown the spot where Pharaoh's daughter found Moses in the bulrushes. Near the spot we sailed from, the Holy Family dwelt when they sojourned in Egypt till Herod should complete his slaughter of the innocents. The same tree they rested under when they first arrived was there a short time ago, but the viceroy of Egypt sent it to the Empress Eugenie lately. He was just in time, otherwise our pilgrims would have had it. The Nile at this point is muddy, swift and turbid, and does not lack a great deal of being as wide as the Mississippi. We scrambled up the steep bank at the shabby town of Gizit, mounted the donkeys again, and scampered away. For 4 or 5 miles the route lay along a high embankment which they say is to be the bed of a railway the Sultan means to build for no other reason than that, when the Empress of the French comes to visit him, she can go to the pyramids in comfort. This is true Oriental hospitality. I am very glad it is our privilege to have donkeys instead of cars. At the distance of a few miles the pyramids rising above the palms looked very clean-cut, very grand and imposing, and very soft and filmy, as well. They swam in a rich haze that took from them all suggestions of unfeeling stone, and made them seem only the airy nothings of a dream structures which might blossom into tiers of vague arches, or ornate colonnades, maybe, and change again, into all graceful forms of architecture, while we looked, and then melt deliciously away, and blend with the tremulous atmosphere. At the end of the levee we left the mules, and went in a sailboat across an arm of the Nile and overflow, and landed where the sands of the Great Sahara left their embankment, as straight as a wall, along the verge of the alluvial plain of the river. A laborious walk in the flaming sun brought us to the foot of the Great Pyramid of Cheops. It was a fairy vision no longer. It was a corrugated unsightly mountain of stone. Each of its monstrous sides was a wide stairway which rose upward, step above step, narrowing as it went, till it tapered to a point far aloft in the air. Insect men and women, pilgrims from the Quaker city, were creeping about its dizzy perches, and one little black swarm were waving postage stamps from the airy summit. Handkerchiefs will be understood. Of course we were besieged by a rabble of muscular Egyptians and Arabs who wanted the contract of dragging us to the top. All tourists are. Of course you could not hear your own voice for the din that was around you. Of course the sheikhs said they were the only responsible parties, that all contracts must be made with them, all monies paid over to them, and none exacted from us by any but themselves alone. Of course they contracted that the varlets who dragged us up should not mention bucksheesh once, for such is the usual routine. Of course we contracted with them, paid them, were delivered into the hands of the draggers, dragged up the pyramids, and harried and bedeviled for bucksheesh from the foundation clear to the summit. We paid it too, for we were purposely spread very far apart over the vast side of the pyramid. There was no help near if we called, and the Hercules's who dragged us had a way of asking sweetly and flatteringly for bucksheesh, which was seductive, and of looking fierce and threatening, to throw us down the precipice, which was persuasive and convincing. Each step being full as high as a dinner table, there being very, very many of the steps, an Arab having hold of each of our arms and springing upward from step to step, and snatching us with them, forcing us to lift our feet as high as our breasts every time, and do it rapidly, and keep it up till we were ready to faint. Who shall say it is not lively, exhilarating, lacerating, muscle-straining, bone-wrenching and perfectly excruciating and exhausting pastime, climbing the pyramids? I beseeched the varlets not to twist all my joints asunder. I iterated, reiterated, even swore to them that I did not wish to beat anybody to the top. Did all I could to convince them that, if I got there the last of all, I would feel blessed above men and grateful to them forever. I begged them, prayed them, pleaded with them to let me stop and rest a moment, only one little moment. And they only answered with some more frightful springs, and an unenlisted volunteer behind opened a bombardment of determined boosts with his head which threatened to batter my whole political economy to wreck and ruin. Twice, for 1 minute, they let me rest, while they extorted bucksheesh, and then continued their maniac flight up the pyramid. They wished to beat the other parties. It was nothing to them that I, a stranger, must be sacrificed upon the altar of their unholy ambition. But in the midst of sorrow, joy blooms. Even in this dark hour I had a sweet consolation. For I knew that except these Mohammedans repented they would go straight to perdition someday. And they never repent, they never forsake their paganism. This thought calmed me, cheered me, and I sank down, limp and exhausted, upon the summit, but happy, so happy and serene within. On the one hand, a mighty sea of yellow sand stretched away toward the ends of the earth, solemn, silent, shorn of vegetation, its solitude uncheered by any forms of creature life. On the other, the Eden of Egypt was spread below us, a broad green floor, cloven by the sinuous river, dotted with villages, its vast distances measured and marked by the diminishing stature of receding clusters of palms. It lay asleep in an enchanted atmosphere. There was no sound, no motion. Above the date-dash plumes in the middle distance, swelled a domed and pinnacled mass, glimmering through a tinted, exquisite mist. Away toward the horizon a dozen shapely pyramids watched over ruined Memphis. And at our feet the bland impassible Sphinx looked out upon the picture from her throne in the sands as placidly and pensively as she had looked upon its like full 50 lagging centuries ago. We suffered torture no pen can describe from the hungry appeals for bucksheesh that gleamed from Arab eyes and poured incessantly from Arab lips. Why try to call up the traditions of vanished Egyptian grandeur? Why try to fancy Egypt following dead Rameses to his tomb in the pyramid, or the long multitude of Israel departing over the desert yonder? Why try to think at all? The thing was impossible. One must bring his meditations cut and dried, or else cut and dry them afterward. The traditional Arab proposed, in the traditional way, to run down Cheops, cross the eighth of a mile of sand intervening between it and the tall pyramid of Sephron, ascend to Sephron's summit and return to us on the top of Cheops all in 9 minutes by the watch, and the whole service to be rendered for a single dollar. In the first flush of irritation, I said let the Arab and his exploits go to the mischief. But stay. The upper third of Sephron was coated with dressed marble, smooth as glass. A blessed thought entered my brain. He must infallibly break his neck. Close the contract with dispatch, I said, and let him go. He started. We watched. He went bounding down the vast broadside, spring after spring, like an ibex. He grew small and smaller till he became a bobbing pygmy, away down toward the bottom, then disappeared. We turned and peered over the other side, 40 seconds, 80 seconds, 100, happiness, he is dead already. 2 minutes and a quarter, there he goes. Too true, it was too true. He was very small now. Gradually, but surely, he overcame the level ground. He began to spring and climb again. Up, 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 at last he reached the smooth coating, now for it. But he clung to it with toes and fingers, like a fly. He crawled this way and that, away to the right, slanting upward, away to the left, still slanting upward, and stood at last, a black peg on the summit, and waved his pygmy scarf. Then he crept downward to the raw steps again, then picked up his agile heels and flew. We lost him presently. But presently again we saw him under us, mounting with undiminished energy. Shortly he bounded into our midst with a gallant war whoop. Time, 8 minutes, 41 seconds. He had won. His bones were intact. It was a failure. I reflected. I said to myself, he is tired, and must grow dizzy. I will risk another dollar on him. He started again. Made the trip again. Slipped on the smooth coating, I almost had him. But an infamous crevice saved him. He was with us once more, perfectly sound. Time, 8 minutes, 46 seconds. I said to Dan, lend me a dollar, I can beat this game, yet. Worse and worse. He won again. Time, 8 minutes, 48 seconds. I was out of all patience now. I was desperate. Money was no longer of any consequence. I said, sir, I will give you $100. To jump off this pyramid head first. If you do not like the terms, name your bet. I scorn to stand on expenses now. I will stay right here and risk money on you, as long as Dan has got a cent. I was in a fair way to win now, for it was a dazzling opportunity for an Arab. He pondered a moment, and would have done it, I think, but his mother arrived then, and interfered. Her tears moved me. I never can look upon the tears of woman with indifference, and I said I would give her 100 to jump off to. But it was a failure. The Arabs are too high priced in Egypt. They put on airs unbecoming to such savages. We descended, hot and out of humor. The dragoman lit candles, and we all entered a hole near the base of the pyramid, attended by a crazy rabble of Arabs who thrust their services upon us uninvited. They dragged us up a long incline chute, and dripped candle grease all over us. This chute was not more than twice as wide, and high as a Saratoga trunk, and was walled, roofed and floored with solid blocks of Egyptian granite as wide as a wardrobe, twice as thick and three times as long. We kept on climbing, through the oppressive gloom, till I thought we ought to be nearing the top of the pyramid again, and then came to the Queen's chamber, and shortly to the chamber of the king. These large apartments were tombs. The walls were built of monstrous masses of smooth granite, neatly joined together. Some of them were nearly as large square as an ordinary parlor. A great stone sarcophagus like a bathtub stood in the center of the king's chamber. Around it were gathered a picturesque group of Arab savages and soiled and tattered pilgrims, who held their candles aloft in the gloom while they chattered, and the winking blurs of light shed a dim glory down upon one of the irrepressible memento seekers who was pecking at the venerable sarcophagus with his sacrilegious hammer. We struggled out to the open air and the bright sunshine, and for the space of 30 minutes received ragged Arabs by couples, dozens, and platoons, and paid them bucksheesh for services they swore and proved by each other that they had rendered, but which we had not been aware of before, and as each party was paid, they dropped into the rear of the procession and in due time arrived again with a newly invented delinquent list for liquidation. We lunched in the shade of the pyramid, and in the midst of this encroaching and unwelcome company, and then Dan and Jack and I started away for a walk. A howling swarm of beggars followed us, surrounded us, almost headed us off. A sheik, in flowing white burnous and gaudy headgear, was with them. He wanted more bucksheesh. But we had adopted a new code. It was millions for defense, but not a cent for bucksheesh. I asked him if he could persuade the others to depart if we paid him. He said yes for 10 francs. We accepted the contract and said, "Now persuade your vassals to fall back." He swung his long staff round his head, and 3 Arabs bit the dust. He capered among the mob like a very maniac. His blows fell like hail, and wherever one fell, a subject went down. We had to hurry to the rescue, and tell him it was only necessary to damage them a little, he need not kill them. In 2 minutes we were alone with the sheik, and remained so. The persuasive powers of this illiterate savage were remarkable. Each side of the Pyramid of Cheops is about as long as the Capitol at Washington, or the Sultan's new palace on the Bosporus, and is longer than the greatest depth of St. Peter's at Rome, which is to say that each side of Cheops extends 700 and some odd feet. It is about 75 feet higher than the cross on St. Peter's. The first time I ever went down the Mississippi, I thought the highest bluff on the river between St. Louis and New Orleans, it was near Selma, Missouri, was probably the highest mountain in the world. It is 413 feet high. It still looms in my memory with undiminished grandeur. I can still see the trees and bushes growing smaller and smaller as I followed them up its huge slant with my eye, till they became a feathery fringe on the distant summit. This symmetrical pyramid of Cheops, this solid mountain of stone reared by the patient hands of men, this mighty tomb of a forgotten monarch dwarfs my cherished mountain. For it is 480 feet high. In still earlier years than those I have been recalling, Holiday's Hill, in our town, was to me the noblest work of God. It appeared to pierce the skies. It was nearly 300 feet high. In those days I pondered the subject much, but I never could understand why it did not sway its summit with never-failing clouds, and crown its majestic brow with everlasting snows. I had heard that such was the custom of great mountains in other parts of the world. I remembered how I worked with another boy, at odd afternoons stolen from study and paid for with stripes, to undermine and start from its bed an immense boulder that rested upon the edge of that hilltop. I remembered how, one Saturday afternoon, we gave 3 hours of honest effort to the task, and saw at last that our reward was at hand. I remembered how we sat down then, and wiped the perspiration away, and waited to let a picnic party get out of the way in the road below, and then we started the boulder. It was splendid. It went crashing down the hillside, tearing up saplings, mowing bushes down like grass, ripping, and crushing and smashing everything in its path, eternally splintered, and scattered a woodpile at the foot of the hill, and then sprang from the high bank clear over a dray in the road. The negro glanced up once, and dodged, and the next second it made infinitesimal mincemeat of a frame cooper's shop, and the coopers swarmed out like bees. Then we said it was perfectly magnificent, and left, because the coopers were starting up the hill to inquire. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.